O Lord Jesus Christ, only begotten Son of thine unurgent Father, thou hast said with thy most pure lips, for without me ye can do nothing. Our God and Lord in faith, having embraced thy words, we fall down before thy goodness. Help us sinners to learn, embrace, and live thy life-giving truth. Send thy Holy Spirit to enlighten upon our souls and to fill us with the light of thy divine knowledge. Guide our thoughts to holy things and rest upon our hearts thy merciful kindness. Grant us eager souls prepared to meet thee in prayer and contemplation of the divine mysteries, and guide us always in thy truth. We humbly beg thine awesome grace in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Pam, would you mind grabbing me a glass of water or something, just so I can have some here? Thank you. I'll take it. Thank you. I ran out. Thank you. What would we do without Pam? We don't know. Well, welcome. Welcome to our a little bit of an abbreviated catechumen lecture series. Because of the church opening in Payson, we've been so occupied with that, we haven't really been able to do this yet. So normally we would have started this in the fall. We would do six classes, take a break for Christmas, Nativity, and then start again right afterwards and do six more classes right before baptism. Now, because we're doing baptisms probably about four times of the year, that kind of gets thrown up into the air about how we're going to do this in the future. But for now, we figured now that Payson is up and running, we'll start the lectures right away and see if we can get as many done as we can. Obviously, with Christmas coming, we're not going to do the one the day after Christmas, so we'll figure it out. But for those of you who are planning to be baptized in January, you'll still come to these for maybe 2 or 3 weeks afterwards as we continue them on. You saw in my email, if you've been a catechumen for at least six months, you are most likely on the list for baptism, but make sure you talk to myself or Father Justin if we haven't talked to you yet. Okay. Even if you're not on that list, you may be aiming towards our Holy Saturday baptisms, which is just a few months later. And if not, then we'll look to the Pentecost, which is 40 days after that. So, or 50 days after that. So it's coming. It's coming whether you're aware of it or not. Time will go quickly. Time will go very, very quickly. And so if you are on the list for this January, you saw a list of things to kind of look at and make sure you're taken care of. So make sure you're thinking about what baptismal name you want. Make sure you're thinking about a sponsor. Please, I emphasize it again, do not ask someone to be your sponsor before you've talked to Father Justin or myself. Because there are some cases, obviously, as spiritual fathers, we know we're pretty intimate with people's lives. And we may have some information that says, not a right good choice for you. This isn't the right person for you. And if you go and ask that person, and then we say that to you, that creates an awkward situation. So the reason I'm really pushing this is because last year we said the same thing, and yet people were like, oh, I already asked so-and-so. We're like, what? So make sure you talk to us first. Beyond that, you want to talk, make sure you talk to Pam. We want to make sure you get measured very, very quickly for a baptismal robe. And then what's the payment, Pam, for the baptismal robe and certificate?
So, and they're separate. So the baptismal robes are $50 for adults and $30 for children. And those payments can be made to the church by check or by cash or to Marie directly. She's the one that makes the robes. So you guys have a few options. You can also pay by credit card, whatever works best for you, and we'll get the money to her. The baptismal certificates are the ones that we send off to the Archdiocese, so you get an actual certificate of your baptism. Those are $10, and those need to be paid to me directly to the church. The only thing I would ask is that if you do pay Marie, that you also let me know, because we kind of tag team, but if there's a whole bunch of us, it's really easy for somebody to slip through the cracks. And I hate to come to people like the day before they're going to be baptized and say, hey, can I have your money, please? So we want all that stuff to be taken care of ahead of time so you guys can just focus on the joy of the baptism and all.
Okay, so in case people watching on Zoom couldn't hear, or also for the recorder, oh, someone else is joining on Zoom.
Sorry.
In case people didn't hear that, or if they're listening to the recording, it's $50 for the baptismal robe. Unless you're for children, it's $30. Pay that directly to Pam, write it out to the church or to Marie Schooler directly, but bring it to Pam. Yes,
yeah.
It'd be easiest if it just everything goes through you. And then the baptismal certificate is $10 per person. So, and if any of that's an issue, let us know. We'll work with you, and we'll figure it out. So, okay, I think that's housekeeping for now. Is that housekeeping, or is there anything else? Okay, that's housekeeping, which is good because we have a lot to get through and not a lot of time to get through it. Because we're doing this abbreviated, I'm trying to pack in a lot in these lectures, and so this is a little bit of a longer one. And I'll also tell you, because of the way this week went, I didn't have the chance to really revise this. Normally, I revise it every time I do it, and I just go based off of notes. But I know how my brain's been functioning this week. It has not been functioning well at all. And so I'm taking an old one that I gave, and basically I'm doing a lot more reading than I normally do. Hopefully by next week I'll be up and running and we can have a little bit more of a kind of open dialogue rather than just a straight read lecture. But today a lot's going to be read, so forgive me for that. So, obviously, strange year for catechumens. Maybe you're not really experiencing that because you haven't been a catechumen before. But normally, what's the big difference for catechumens? What's the huge thing that we're missing right now? Right here, in this room, fellowship. Why does that make a difference? Well, I'm asking you to find a sponsor, and you haven't had much of a chance to interact with other parishioners, right? You're missing kind of the social aspect of the church, which, by the way, is not what we would consider the secular aspect of the church. The social aspect is part of the spiritual aspect, because we worship together, and then we live together, right? And so this is a normal part of church life that you are being deprived of right now, and that's not a good thing. We don't like that. We'd rather that you were able to kind of interact with people, get to know them, and that'll make you feel more comfortable in general. So it's a little bit of a different situation for you. Obviously, we're hoping that that will change. However, the fundamentals of catechism can still remain, right? The fundamentals of what we're doing. So for the next next lectures, I don't want to say the next weeks because we will take certain weeks off, but I want to tell you what to look forward to just based on the titles of the lectures. So today we'll be talking about the nature of God, which is obviously the important starting point for us. Lecture 2 will be the nature of man and the fall. Lecture 3 will be Jesus Christ. Number 4 will be the church. Number 5, we'll talk about church history, mainly focusing on the ecumenical councils. And that's also where we're going to get a lot of Trinitarian theology. Number 6 will be the holy mysteries. Those would normally be seven lectures in and of themselves. I think I said 6 and 6 before. It was 7 and 7 lectures. So 14 total is what we normally do. So we're cutting this in half, and that's one of the ways we're doing that. All 7 holy mysteries we're going to talk about in one lecture. And then talk number 7 will be asceticism and life after death issues. Okay, so we're going to miss a lot in this. We're going to try to pack it in. Like, obviously, we don't talk too much about the services. We want to make sure we talk about that. Maybe we'll talk about that when we talk about the church. We want to talk about saints and icons and all these different things. Some of that won't get in this. So one of the things that's really, I really encourage you to do it, I know a lot of you already do this, is I try to meet with each catechumen once every month or two. And what have I told you to do? Have a notebook, write down your questions, and we'll just sit and go through all the questions one by. I love doing that. It's one of my favorite things to do. I want to make sure you're actually doing it, though. So I really encourage you to do that. And it's up to you to tell me I'm ready to meet. Okay? I know I can't reach out to every person. There's just a lot of different people. I don't know who's going to Father Justin. My week gets packed really quickly. And so it's your responsibility to contact me and just say, I'm ready to meet again. We have a whole bunch of questions we want to run through. Awesome, let's do it. I promise you, I get excited about it. I love doing that. You know me. You know Father Jess. We're talkers. So we enjoy doing that. That's on you, though. So if you find stuff missing in here that you really want to know about, by all means, reach out to us. At the same time, I don't want you to feel like you're getting gypped, that somehow you're missing out on the greater catechism, because while the educational aspect is important, while knowing things is important, that's not the foundation of your catechism. This is one of the things that differentiates us from a lot of other denominations and churches. This is not about just learning, making sure you learn the right amount of information, and then at the end we give you a test, and if you get a passing grade, then you get baptized. It's not the way it works. And that's why, in some cases, we've had people who, they were not catechumens for 6 months. They weren't catechumens for a year. They were catechumens for multiple years, because we want to see that the faith is being planted and it's getting deep roots in your heart. So there are three foundations for a good catechism. A good catechism is going to have these three foundations. Number one, orientation to the divine services. Number two, beginnings of the spiritual life. And number three, being a servant. Learning to be a servant for Christ, for the church, and for others. So I want to talk a little bit about each one of these, but I want you to note, catechism is just the beginning of this process. Not a single one of those ends when you get baptized. It doesn't end. It continues on. So what you're doing is you're reforming your life so that these become normalized, so that after baptism, you just continue with what you began. And I'm going to tell you one of the dirty little secrets. One of the dirty secrets here is a lot of people think once I'm baptized, the struggle's over, everything's going to be all roses after that. I always say, sunshine, lollipops, and rainbow. Nope. That's not the way it works. It's one of my favorite. There's a Protestant book on spiritual warfare from one of these television guys. And he put on the cover a guy leaning back in a lounge chair on the beach, leaning back. And the whole point of the book is God has done all the work for you. You can just lay back and be saved now. Is that the example given to us in the scriptures? We have an example of somebody who's kind of important. His name was Jesus. And Jesus went and got baptized. And what's the first thing he did after he was baptized? It says the Spirit did what? Drove him into the desert. And it tells us the purpose of being driven to the desert. Why was he driven in the desert? To do battle with Satan. Christ gives us the example and the truth that it's after baptism that the true battle... You'll notice some of the battle beforehand, but it's after that it really hits you hard. Why? Because now the devil sees something in you that he wants to steal. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that and the dangers. Let's just talk about it now. I'm going to reorder some of this. There are two ways that the devil fights you. One is head-on. Okay? You know what head-on temptation looks like, right? Okay, for guys, you're walking down the street, beautiful girl, scantily dressed, walks down, and your eyes go zip, and your mind goes there. That's a pretty head-on one. Or another one, you're driving along one day, somebody cuts you off, and suddenly you're saying words that your mother would have put soap in your mouth after. Right? That's what we do. There's head-on temptation. Right there in the face, and a lot of times what it does is it catches us off guard, and that's why, boom, we just kind of engage with it. How effective is that in the long term? Eventually you notice it and you're able to fight it. Right? This is the devil handing you a vial or a little bottle that has a skull and crossbones on it that is labeled poison. And he says, here, take this. And if you're not thinking, you go, fine, and you take it. But in most cases, you take a look at it and go, oh, this is not good for me. So what does the devil do instead? He pours that poison into his recipe, and that turns into these beautiful, warm, very good-smelling chocolate chip cookies. And he hands you those and says, here, have one of these. And you go, ooh, that's tempting. Yes, please. So one type of temptation is head-on. Another type of temptation is one that is a little bit more underhanded and presents itself as something really beautiful. And a lot of times, in most cases, and I'll tell you this, I'm warning you right now, be prepared for this, it really tempts you with the worst word that the devil uses for us, the most dangerous word for us. And that word is tomorrow. Tomorrow. I'm too tired to do my prayers. I can do it tomorrow. I didn't really fast today. I'm not going to fast tonight either. This day's gone. I'll start fasting tomorrow. I'll take care of all this tomorrow. And what happens is you slowly start to fall away. This happens, I'm telling you right now, you've heard it from my mouth. Every single year after baptism, people who have been so dedicated during the catechumenate period, who have been here every single Sunday, every Saturday night, often multiple times during the week, who have been saying their prayers, who have been fasting, who have been doing all the spiritual reading, and then boom, they disappear. And sometimes they disappear at first for a week, then they come back. Maybe it's 2 weeks and come back. And then a little bit more, and eventually we don't see them anymore. And they get a text from Father Justin or myself saying, hey, just checking in, seeing how you're doing. And they go, oh, I'm doing fine. Just, you know, life's just been really busy. It's been really busy. But you'll see me. You'll see me if not this week, next week. And then we don't see them. And sometimes we don't see them ever again. It happens every single year. So beware of that. Be watchful over this temptation. I promise you, ambivalence will start to creep in. So we need to be watchful about this. We need to be ready for this. You need to watch out for this really, really closely. And a lot of times the devil won't push it too hard during the catechumenate period. For some people, it's hard during the catechumenate period. For a lot of people, he waits until afterwards, so it's a big surprise. And because ambivalence, the nature of ambivalence is you don't really notice it because you just kind of stop caring. And excuses come in and the word tomorrow starts coming in more and more and you fall away. I promise you, the temptation for that will come. So be watchful for it. So, these things never end. Let's talk about these three, as I'm already spending way too much time on page 1 of 12. Of 13, sorry. So, number 1, orientation to divine services. At first, orientation means introduction, okay? And that's important because we have to learn the way we worship. But after becoming an Orthodox Christian, to orient yourself means to redirect yourself, right? When we reorient ourselves, we're reorienting ourselves in a new direction. This is what the services do for us. They constantly reorient ourselves towards heaven by spending time in heaven on earth. This, by the way, you notice most Orthodox churches, we don't have a steeple. The image of a steeple is an image of man reaching up to God. In the Orthodox Church, we mostly have domes, and we have that curved ceiling, right, with this image of Christ right in the middle. What is that? It's Christ bending the heavens and coming down to us. It's a different image. And so this is what the services are, is that the more we cleanse ourselves and can perceive spiritual realities, we start to realize the services really are heaven on earth. At first, they feel boring and long and painful. But more and more, over time, you'll start to notice, this is actually heaven on earth. And many of the saints talk about what really goes on. And they'll tell you, they see with their own eyes. They see the place filled with angels. They see the saints' present. You know, there's a prayer right before the priest comes out with the gospel that asks that the angels be with us and worship with us. There are many saints who have seen the angels take the priest by the arm and lead him out without him even realizing it. This is what happens in the services. But in order to be that way, in order to see that way, we have to live heavenly lives. And the services help direct us towards that heavenly vision. They transform us from the inside out. Number 2, beginning of the spiritual life. Of course, we'll talk more about this in the weeks to come. But what we do at church cannot be like a weekly gas station visit. All week, I'm just going to let the grace kind of flood out. I'm going to forget these things, become ambivalent. But then I'm going to go to church on Sunday, and I'm going to fill back up, and then I'm going to go live the life. Because what we're doing there is we're compartmentalizing our lives. Church is the spiritual place, and this is the real world. Father Justin uses a line that's very good where he says, we can't be people who live in the world and go to church. We ought to be people who live in the church and go into the world. It's a very, very different perspective. This transforms the way we live. So we constantly fill up. We don't just fill up in church, in the physical church building, but we fill up before our icons, morning and evening. We fill up during the day as we take our prayer open. We pray the Jesus prayer. We constantly do this. We constantly try to drive out the sins that are trying to settle back in our heart and to bring in more grace to drive it out. These two, by the way, the communal services of the church and the personal spiritual life, they feed into one another. You want to experience the divine liturgy really powerfully? Live a really ascetic and spiritual life the week before. Prepare yourself every day and be thinking about it. Have it on your heart. By the time liturgy comes, you'll experience it differently. And that grace will feed into you, and then you're going to come out and see things differently as well. This happens also with monastery visits. Right, Sarah? Sarah just got back from a monastery, and she talked to me about this. She sent me some texts, and all these things that are kind of, and it become normal for you. At the monastery, she goes, oh, they're not normal anymore. And she's able to go back into the world and go, okay, now I can take this grace with me. And we want these two things to feed into one another. By the way, a monastery visit, something you should plan on doing at some point. All right. We are, by the way, when I say the beginning of your spiritual life, you may say, yeah, I'm at the beginning now, but in a year, I don't want to be the beginning anymore. We are always at the beginning. We're always at the beginning because we're always moving forward. We're always moving forward. Which means we always have this in front of us, and here we are at the beginning of that line in front of us. There's no standing still in the spiritual life. Let me repeat that. There's no standing. You're either moving forward or you're moving backwards. There's no standing still in the spiritual life. Why? Because if you're standing still, what it means is you've become accustomed to simply being as you are, which means what are you not doing? Yearning for greater repentance. Yearning to love Christ more. Trying to grow in humility. You've stopped trying to grow, which means you've become ambivalent, which means you're not actually sitting still. You're actually moving backwards without realizing it. We're constantly moving in the spiritual life. This is why one of the things that I think really plagues our world today is this misunderstanding of who Christ was. And we think of Christ as that gentle, kind shepherd who is always so nice. Read the Gospels, people. Was Christ always super gentle? One minute he tells Peter, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and earth has not revealed this to you." But and then like a few verses later, he's like, "Get behind me, Satan." So Christ spent a lot of time making people very uncomfortable. And we don't do that because we want you to be uncomfortable and miserable, but rather because we don't want to fall too comfortably within whatever situation we're in and in this world. This is not our true homeland. That's our true homeland. So we constantly want to be moving more towards a heavenly lifestyle, a heavenly way of living, which is why there is no standing still. We're always at the beginning. We're always moving forward. This is one of the great stories from the lives of the saints, Saint Sisois, S-I-S-O-E-S. He was a disciple of Saint Anthony the Great. He basically took over after Saint Anthony died, beloved by thousands of monks who were under his care. And as he was on his deathbed, a bunch of monks were surrounding him, and they could hear him kind of murmuring. He was talking. And they said, "Abba, we can't understand you. What are you saying?" He goes, "I'm not talking to you. Who are you talking to?" And he said, "Well, Christ has sent a legion of angels and saints and apostles here, and they're here to take my soul so that they can bring it to the throne of God." And they're shocked, and they say, "Well, what in the world are you saying to them?" He said, "I'm asking them to leave." "Asking them to leave for what reason? Could you possibly, why would you want them to leave?" And he said, "I'm asking them for just a little bit more time to repent." And they looked at him and said, "Abba, you have worthily taken the place of St. Anthony after his repose. You have counseled thousands of monks. The whole world looks to you as an example. You have worked miracles through your prayers. You've even raised the dead. What could you possibly have to repent over?" And his response was, "Truly, I don't know if I've even begun to repent." That is so darn orthodox. That's the way we live the spiritual life. Again, not in misery, but always with hope and always striving to live a life more pleasing to Christ. This is our goal. We want a day that Christ can smile upon. And of course, that's almost impossible for us, and so we constantly strive for it. And you may say, "Well, as you get closer to God, doesn't that sense go away?" No, because the closer you are to God, the brighter the light is. And the brighter the light is, the more you can see every little speck and stain and every little thing that needs to be cleaned. This is why St. Paul could call himself the chief among sinners. The closer he got to Christ, the more he was able to see every little speck of sin. Finally, 3, being a servant. Be a servant for Christ, for the church, and for others. What we gain from God must be given out. We don't just keep it to ourselves. Otherwise, we're leeches. You can't be leeches in the spiritual life. Come and get all the good things from the church and then offer nothing. So when we start fellowship again, you know, we have food teams. Be on a food team. We have cleaning crews. Be on a cleaning crew. I was really happy to see a couple of the catechumens signed up immediately. Andrew Stallman told me when that email went out this past week. You know, if you have the gift of a good voice and can read music, be in the choir. If you can't do any of that stuff, and by the way, not everyone has that gift, and you know, we're pretty blunt here. We may look at you and say, "We love your fervor. This is not your gift. This is not what you're set for. That's okay." But there's other ways you can help. You can help with, you know, meal trains when those pop up. Or, if you don't have kids here, help with some of the mothers who are struggling. My wife will love you forever if you go to her and say, "Which kid can I help with?" She'll love you forever. There are plenty of mothers who need that help. There's plenty of ways to help. And there's plenty of ways to share your faith without being overbearing on other people. If somebody's really struggling in your life, and they're talking to you about it, you can let them know, "You know, I found a lot of solace in my faith. I found a lot of struggle there, but I found a lot of solace there too. Come and see." You can invite people. So just don't keep everything to yourself. Become a servant for others. And learn to give your life with a lot of joy. St. Paisios has a word that he would use all the time in Greek called philotimo. And philotimo is this joyful giving where you have so much gratitude towards others and towards God for all that you have that there's no sense of self left. No sense of self left. So all you want to do is give yourself. You want to give yourself a joy. You want to give your time. You want to give in whatever way you can help others. And the very act of giving just brings you joy because you want nothing repaid. Just the fact that you have that joy in giving fills you. He talks a lot about this word. This is what we need, philotimo. I told somebody in confession today, I said, if we just lived like 2 days a year with true philotimo, it would so transform our lives that the other 363 days would also be transformed. This is what we need. So again, the church is the center of our life. This is the goal and desire of our community. There's no other way. There's no other way. The church is the center of our life. And so as catechumens, when we instruct you in the Christian faith, our goal is to help you learn how to live with the church as the center of your life. So that there is no compartmentalization. You don't have a church life, a work life, a friend life, a family life. Rather, you have up here this line. You have a work life and a family life and a friend life and an entertainment life. But surrounding it is the church. So Father Josiah Trenum gives this image where he says, our life ought to be lived such as if we have a gigantic rubber band wrapped around our waist and we wrap the other side of it around the altar of the church. And no matter where we go, we're constantly being pulled back to the altar. Constantly being pulled back to the services and to God. It's an awesome image. But everything, wherever you are, there's that tension where you go, oh yeah, God is always, I'm always being reminded of God. He's always there no matter what I'm doing. And so it affects every aspect of your life. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about what this catechism typically looks like in the early church. Now, you may say 6 months, way too long. A year, way too long. Early church, when was it? How long was it? 3 years. 3 years at least. Because people were completely reforming their lives. And so 6 months to a year, not too bad. You may look in the scriptures and say, well, yeah, but some people were baptized right away. Yeah, the Jews who were expectantly waiting for the Messiah had been preparing themselves. So when they accepted him, this wasn't too big of a change for them. But at the same time, St. Paul would spend years with communities making sure that they knew what they were doing. Right? We get these letters that are, you know, maybe 5 chapters or maybe 16 chapters, Romans. But in most cases, he had spent years with them, and he had instructed them. And these letters are written after years and years of instruction with these communities. And so, pretty early on, the church said, you know, especially because we're bringing in a lot of pagans, a lot of people who aren't used to this, we're going to bring them in over a long period. And we're going to make sure that they have a sponsor who, actually during the catechumenate period, was the one who was responsible for really examining their life closely, as was the bishop or the priest who ended up actually baptizing them. So, typically 3 years. And one of the reasons for that is because that reorientation process that we talked about takes a long time. We're not just learning a different way of thinking, we're learning a different way of living. Okay? And that new way of thinking, by the way, it's going to continue on, even after baptism. St. Sophronie of Essex, who reposed in 1993, he says, after someone is brought into the faith, it takes about 20 years to really become Orthodox. You may sit there and say, I don't know if I have that much time. But don't worry about it, because the process itself is part of it. And the reason for that, I like to give this image where, imagine that you have a worldview. There's a certain way you view the world and people and things and yourself. And that's in this nice box. And as you become Orthodox, you look at all these pieces that make up the inside of this box. And you go, oh, you know what? This piece doesn't work anymore. And you take it out and you put the Orthodox piece in. And then, oh, this one doesn't work either. You take that one, put the Orthodox. And you keep doing this for years. Eventually, you're going to find out, oh boy, I've got a problem. Because all these pieces weren't meant to ever fit inside this box to begin with. I have to let the whole box crumble and then rebuild from the bottom up. That takes a while. It happened in my own life. You know, I've had a few times, years and years after being Orthodox, after becoming Orthodox, where I went, oh boy, this whole thing is broken. I've been trying to fit these Orthodox pieces in a not Orthodox box. I need to let the whole thing fall. It was humbling experiences. But I look back now and I say, okay, now all that time that I seemed confused and I wasn't really sure what was going on and I thought God wasn't involved, now I see how he was involved the whole process through. So be patient with yourself. Be very patient. But within this, you're going to find that there's two types of knowledge. We know this inherently anyway. There's head knowledge and there's heart knowledge. And they're very, very different things, and they cause very different approaches to God. When I talk about heart knowledge, I want you to understand, I'm not talking just about feelings. Okay, this is not about just feelings. And this is a big mistake that happens in a lot of the Protestant West, in a lot of the evangelical churches, where you feel the Spirit when you feel excited and joyful about God. And that's suddenly God is working in your life. And what happens with that a lot of times is that when people stop feeling that, because eventually the feeling goes away, well, they don't want other people to see that, because then that means that you don't have enough faith. And so what do? You have to fake it. And that goes on for a while until it kind of falls away. This is often what happens. In the Orthodox Church, we understand that sometimes you're going to feel it, and sometimes it's just going to feel really arduous and difficult, and that's okay. It doesn't mean God is not working. In fact, I really want you to understand this. Again, St. Sophronie, he has one of my favorite quotes where he says, the purpose of grace is to teach us how to act when grace has departed. In other words, he talks about the spiritual life like waves. Sometimes you have this spiritual high, Fasting, prostrations, prayer, church attendance, it's all easy. Everything's going great. And then, steep decline, and suddenly now, even saying, like, 20 Jesus prayers is, like, impossible. Really difficult. He says the purpose of those high periods isn't that suddenly you're a great spiritual person, everything's great. It's simply to teach you how to live so that when that sense of grace has departed, you continue to live the same way. Why is that important? Well, if everything remains a spiritual high, are you living your spiritual life because you love Christ? Or is there a danger that you're living it simply because you love the spiritual high? And you're just trying to fill yourself more with yourself, that great feeling. There's a big danger there. You're not doing things for God, you're doing things because it feels good. I give people the image all the time. I say, go to the gym and pick up 2-pound weights. Curl those a few times and congratulations, you've just wasted your time. Pick up heavy weights. 25, 30, 35, 40 pounds. Start lifting those if your gauge, what is it, like 55 pounds or... He's buff. Whatever it is he's doing. You want to pick up the heavy ones. Why? Is more pain involved? Yes. Is more struggle involved? Yes. Are you going to be sore tomorrow? Yes. But that's how you build muscle. And that's just, it's true spiritually as well. It has to get tough. Because that's when you really grow spiritually. Because no longer am I doing it for the good feeling. This doesn't feel good. No longer am I doing it for the excitement. I'm bored. But I'm doing it because I love Christ. Or at least I want to love Christ. And so I'm going to push through. This is when we really grow spiritually. When things get tough. So that sense of heart knowledge doesn't mean, again, always an emotional high. That can be really dangerous. It can be really self-centered. What it means is that we're constantly seeking to empty ourselves, of our pride, of our egoism, and make room for God. And the hard work is done when it's tough. And that's why we have the church constantly here, and you have your spiritual fathers to help you through those times. But they'll happen, and it'll go up and down and up and down, and that's just the nature of the spiritual life. Every now and then, when it's down for a while, eventually, St. Joseph of Hesychus says, God will give you a little spiritual candy. And he'll remind you, why am I doing this? Oh yeah, that's why. I had a great experience of God's love and grace, and I just, oh, I want that. I want to be like that. And then he takes it away again. You go down, and that's just the nature of the spiritual life. So how do you gain heart knowledge? Again, it's not through the education. I mean, we're going to give you a lot of education with these 7 lectures. But you gain it mainly through living the life. And this is why there's always a balance between doctrine and worship. And when I say worship, I don't just mean what we do in the church. I mean how we live as Christians. The ancient Latin phrase for this was lex orandi, lex credendi. The rule of prayer is the rule of faith. We're going to talk more about that at the end of today if I can get there, which I'm not doing a good job of. So we're going to keep going. The rule of prayer is the rule of faith. How you pray will express and inform what you believe. Those two things have to be balanced. And so, again, having all the head knowledge, that can be good, but it can also be really dangerous because what ends up happening if all you do is head knowledge stuff? You get prideful. And that's what happens with what we call the crazy convert syndrome. I went through this when I was in college and started paying attention to my faith for the first time. I read every book I could, and I knew what orthodoxy really was, and I knew who was doing it wrong, and this church is doing it wrong, and this priest is doing it wrong, and I became a judgmental jerk. I was going to use a different phrase, there were kids here. I became another one, started with a J. Hee-haw, that's what I was. I was a jerk. And was I actually cleansing my heart? No, I was making it worse. It's dangerous. It's dangerous because I wasn't really going home and putting it into practice. Had I been put it in practice, I would have been praying more, fasting more, and repenting more. But instead, I used all this head knowledge to just be right. Orthodoxy is not about being right. It's about living rightly. And if you have faith, and if you're so sure of that faith, but you don't have humility, you are living your faith ideologically. Which is not true faith. That will be your condemnation. Christ will say, well, you knew all this stuff. Why didn't you put it into practice? You're responsible for what you know. You're not really living it. Before any doctrine was ever written down, it existed where? In the hearts of the Christians and in the heart of the church's worship. The best catechism then for you is an active, attentive participation in the services of the church. There is no true theologian of the church, no saint, who became so simply by going to church only once a week. That is a modern Protestant invention, this idea that church is just for Sundays only. Worship was for them and should be for us a very way of life. Do you know how often they went to church in the early church? Twice a day. every morning, every evening. Now, do we have that expectation for you? No, we live in a different world. We get it. But it does mean you're doing your prayers morning and evening. It means for great feasts of the church, if you can get it off work, by any means, you get it off work and come to services. This is why we do a lot of evening like vigils for major feasts, because we want you to be able to come. I would normally tell you this year, make sure you take December 6th off, because it's the great feast of St. Nicholas, which is one of the greatest saint commemorated in the church, besides the Theotokos, she's on a different level, but lucky for you, it's on a Sunday this year. So, but normally, this is a day that we encourage everyone, take your kids out of school, and if you can get even a couple hours off of work, come to liturgy. This is the center of our life. Saturday evenings, not an option for us. This is what we do. This is how we live as Orthodox Christians. It's not something where we debate. We go, I guess I want to live. No, we just go, no, this is just the way it is, like getting up and brushing your teeth. How many of you get up every morning and debate whether you're going to brush your teeth that day? Hopefully no one. This is the way it is with us. We just do our morning prayers. We do our evening prayers. We attend church whenever we possibly can. This is the way of life for the Orthodox. So Orthodoxy is not just a different set of ideas. It's a different way of life. And the extent of that means that it's a different way of living in every way. A different way of thinking. A different way of speaking. A different way of breathing. St. Gregory the Theologian says we ought to pray more than we breathe. this is how we do it. This is how we live. And this life that we're supposed to live and this faith that we're supposed to believe, this is the key. We're going to talk a lot about this today. They are revealed to us. They're not something someone just came up with one day and decided, hey, this is a good idea. These are things that God reveals to us. He promises in the Gospel of John. He says, I'll send you the Holy Spirit who will lead you into all truth. All truth about what we believe and how we live. This is what the apostles gained. And this is what the life of the faith means for the saints who continue to live this life and show us how to live as well. They lead the way for us. So this means that the God that we worship is one who desires to be known. He wants to be known by us. And that's what we're going to talk about today, now that I'm already 40 minutes in almost. Who is this God? Who is this God that we worship? A lot of heavy stuff. I'm going to go through it quickly. Forgive me. I'm going to stop every now and then. Normally, I'm going to wait till the end for questions. This time, because it's so heavy, I'm going to stop every now and then and ask for questions. So this is the question. The question. Who is God? It is the most significant, the most impactful, and the most exalted question that man can ask. It's why we began today with prayer and the sign of the cross. We are speaking of significant things here and holy things. It's a terrible sign of the times that this question, who is God, is so ignored, with the assumption that different beliefs about God mean that there is no right answer. That is not true. There are right and wrong answers about God. And we seek the God who reveals himself to us and reveals proper answers. A person who does not seek to know who God is not living as a true person. You can't know yourself if you don't know who God is. We lose our humanity if we ignore this question. And I think you can look around the world today and say, have we lost our humanity? Yes. I don't think there's any question about it. If you don't believe me, find a debate on Facebook. And you tell me that we haven't lost our humanity. We've lost it because we stopped asking this question. Who is God? That's why we begin here. So let's look at the statement of faith, the Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed. That's how we're going to begin to delve into this great mystery. The very first line, right? I believe in one God, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth and of all things visible and invisible. So the creed in its very first sentence recognizes our starting point. God as maker or creator. This is where we're going to start. This is the term which most of the martyrs, by the way, typically would use when preaching, even right before their death. Right before they were martyred, they would preach God as creator. So why is that so significant? Why do I say that this is actually a very deep concept? It's probably one of the most precise words we could use for God, and we're going to talk about why. There's a lot in that we don't normally think of right away. And for the martyrs, it immediately distinguished the God of Christianity from the gods of paganism and Greek philosophy. Immediately, right off the bat. A martyr would refuse to make sacrifices or pay homage to one of these multiple idols that they had. And usually they had these big temples, and then they had a little podium, and there was a 2-foot, maybe less, idol. And then they would go and worship towards that. And it was an object of wood or metal. And they would refuse. And they'd say, what would they say? Something along these lines. I will not bow down before an object of wood or metal which was made with human hands. Instead, I worship the one true God who created all things. This is what distinguished them from the pagans. God as creator. So creation assumes something happened in space, right? If you create something, it has to happen somewhere. So there's space and time. Why time? Well, if there's a moment when something doesn't exist and then a later moment when it does exist, it assumes time. So when we talk about creation, we're talking about God working in space and time. If God created all everything around us, the question then becomes, well, who created God? Right? We've probably heard that question from atheists. But God himself exists outside of space and time. So there was no time when God was not, or when he became into existence, because you can't talk about before. There is no before. God is the same yesterday, today, and always. He's outside of space and time. We have no concept of what that looks like. None whatsoever. And we're going to talk about why. So the question becomes, what else besides God exists outside of space and time? What else of God, besides God, what else has the nature of being uncreated? Nothing. Nothing. This statement, I worship a God who created all things, it causes us to immediately separate God from his creation, in essence, in the essence of things. So when we talk about essence, we're talking about that which makes something what it is. What's the essence of a chair? It's something made to be sat in. You know, a chair has four legs. Is that its essence? No, because you can have a chair with a stool with three legs. It's meant to be sat in. Okay. The essence of God, what makes God what he is that he's uncreated, and that makes him different from all other things in existence. Nothing shares with God this single attribute, that he's uncreated. Okay? Do we understand? This is important that we understand this little concept before we move on. Do we understand this? Only God is uncreated. He has an essence, a nature, that is different from everything else in existence. Okay? Got it? Good. This means that everything we see, everything we taste, everything we touch, everything we smell, even things that we think that we can't smell, taste, or touch, everything, objects, laws of nature, philosophical concepts, metaphysical concepts, anything that exists apart from God, even angels and demons, all have one attribute in common. They are created. They're created. Man is included in this. So this, you know, what makes man similar to a rock? And what makes those similar to the movements and speed and course of a planetary rotation? They all have the same nature in the sense that they were all created. They exist in space and time, and they were created. And they're part of God's creation. So we can't imagine, even to the smallest degree, what something outside of space and time is like. Okay? So I want you to think. Think of what it means to be outside of space and time. Before God created anything, what was it like? And most people, what happens is their mind immediately goes to blackness. But, you messed up, because blackness is a thing that you can see, and therefore, you're wrong. You already messed up. We there's no way we can do it. We can't imagine it. And yet God does exist outside of space and time. So there's no age with God. We don't say how old he is. He has no beginning. And we can't understand that, and this precisely because we don't share this characteristic. We are created. I know I'm hammering this point over and over again. You're going to see why. This means that all of our knowledge is based on things we can observe. And we can only observe things that share a common essence, things that were created. And this is the basis of all of our understanding. Things created. Okay? So God being the creator is incredibly important to us. And this immediately sets us apart from the Greek philosophers and the Greek pagans of the time. Many people believed, like Plato did, and still believe that created matter is eternal like God. That it's always existed, and God was just simply the one who took the clay, the material that was without form, and then gave form to it. But if that were the case, though, then the essence of matter and the essence of God would be the same. They would be uncreated, and thus, there'd be good reason to worship the pagan gods. You see why they did this? To worship an idol was perfectly, it made a lot of sense, because matter was uncreated, just like the gods were, And so they share a common nature. And thus, when you get you know, like an emperor who happens to be really beloved, he can become a demigod, which is what happened to the pagan emperors after the Roman Republic. The emperors became kind of worshipped in a way. But we know this isn't so. Matter itself has a beginning. It began when God, who has no beginning or end himself, since outside of time there's no conception of beginning or end, matter began when God created it. So if God exists in a state beyond the limitations of created time and space, this means that looking for God, searching for him out in space, is a pretty ridiculous thing. This happened. There's a quote that's attributed to the Soviet astronaut Yuri Gagarin, I think is how you pronounce his name. And the quote is when he was out in space, he didn't see any God up there. We don't really know if he actually said this or if, was it Khrushchev, I think? If Khrushchev, who was in power at the time, is the one who applied it to him. Khrushchev said something along the lines of, like, Gagarin flew to space and saw no God. But of course, it's a ridiculous way of thinking about it because God doesn't exist within space and time. This, by the way, really important, this on that test I said you're not going to have, this will be on the test. This is also why Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, is one of the worst Star Trek movies and probably one of the worst movies ever made. Because they're out there and they find a being who says he's God, but he's trapped on a planet. And it's so stupid. It's so stupid. So don't go watch that movie if you've never seen it. It's not worth it. That will be on the final exam. Star Trek V, one of the worst movies ever made. All of creation around us came from no prior elements. So it's not like when you make a chair, you take wood that already exists and then you make it into a chair, or like an Apple product, like my phone, and they take existing material and they reform it and put it all together. This is not how it happened. God created what we call ex nihilo, which means out of nothing. So if there's just nothing and there's nothing to do anything with it, nothing can't form into something by itself, right? And this is one of the reasons that the Big Bang is such a ridiculous idea. The Big Bang without God doesn't work. You say that there was nothing, and then there was an explosion, and then it created something. And so some people say, well, no, the Big Bang was actually particles flying, and they collided, and... Okay, but where did the particles come from? You haven't explained the beginning yet. You've explained formation out of something, but not nothing, or something out of nothing. You can't explain something out of nothing unless there's a God to do this. Okay? So there must be a cause, essentially, and that cause is God. And why is this important? If God exists in a manner completely ununderstandable to us, to coin a phrase, or non-comprehensible to us, no matter how hard we try, we will never comprehend something existing out of space and time. We've covered that. Because every reference point we have for knowledge exists inside of space and time. Everything that we know comes from concepts and things we can observe that are created. Okay? So what ends up happening is that people take human concepts, and these human concepts get close to explaining the attributes of God, but they always fall short to one degree or another. They always fall short. I'll give you an example. Eventually, when we talk about the ecumenical councils, we're going to talk more about Trinitarian theology. And in the Trinity, we believe that there's one God in three persons, or more precisely what we call three hypostases, which is the Greek word for it. We believe there's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. One of the contemporary Muslim criticisms, and actually one of the ancient Muslim criticisms of Christianity, is that if God is Father and God is also Son, well, we know, they would say, that everyone who is a child or a son has a father and a mother. And therefore, Trinitarian theology doesn't work because you have a father, but you don't have a mother eternally. And therefore, Trinitarian theology just falls flat and it doesn't work. What's the problem with that? You're using a created human concept and applying it to the uncreated God. Just because a human person needs a human father and a mother doesn't mean that God the Son needs a God the Father and God the Mother. So it's wrong to apply that concept. In theological terms, we would say God is totally other. From us, totally other. Okay? So Muslims try to apply a characteristic of created beings to an uncreated God, and that just doesn't work. It would be like if we had, like God, the power of pure creation. Okay? That is, to create without using previous existing materials. If we could do that. And we created a species of creature with two heads. Alright? And then this species sees us, their creator, and automatically assumes that we had a second head hidden somewhere, because if they all have second heads, the creator must have a second head, right? They'd be doing exactly what Muslims do when they criticize Christianity. They'd be taking their concept of what it means to exist and trying to apply it to God. It doesn't work that way. Okay? Of course, that's a very an odd example, because we ourselves are created. But again, it's just an idea of how we perceive things is important. We have to understand that we can't apply human concepts to God in that way. Okay, are you with me so far? With me? Yes? Yes? Anybody not with me? Awesome. Okay. So to understand this, we begin to see the difference and importance of two types of theology that the saints of the church talk about. And the two types are called cataphatic theology and apophatic theology. You're going to learn a lot of terms today. So cataphatic theology is saying what God is, making a positive statement about God. And apophatic theology is saying what God is not, what we call negative theology. It's this type of theology, apophatic theology, that is always more precise for created beings talking about God, who is totally other than us. And this is what we see mostly with the hymns and the saints of the church. They use apophatic theology. They talk more about what God is not. So what are some terms that we would talk about to say what God is not? You're actually more familiar with these than you probably realize. For instance, invisible is an apophatic term. Invisible means not visible. God is invisible. God is not visible. Incomprehensible. God cannot be comprehended. Indescribable. He can't be properly described. Infinite, even. The word infinite means not finite. There's no limitation to God. So these are words that we use all the time. He's unsearchable. God is. He dwells in unapproachable light, etc., etc., etc. We use these terms all the time. And these are the main terms we use to describe God and his characteristics. In these terms, we don't say what God is. We say what he is not. And in telling us what God is not, we begin to gain glimpses into who God actually is, but in a way that can't really be put into words. And this is the benefit to this approach, is it keeps us rather safe. So one of the lines that I use all the time, I'd say memorize this line if you can. Theology is describing in human and finite terms a God that is divine and infinite. Theology is describing in human and finite terms a God that is divine and infinite. In other words, theology is impossible. You cannot use finite and human words to describe something that is divine and infinite. The two share nothing in their natures. They have different natures. So one of the images I give all the time about orthodoxy, oversimplification, yes, I'll admit right from the start, but I still think it's important. What happened in the West is this. Imagine that the mystery of God is floating right in front of us. This is a big amalgamous ball of light. It's pulsating and, you know, whatever it is. And the Pope came along and he looked at this and he said, I want to write down every characteristic about this that I can see. Everything that I can describe about this, I want to write down. He starts writing everything down. And this is kind of what Thomas Aquinas did in his Summa. He actually goes through every question he can think of about God. You know, the kind of parody of this became, how many angels can stand on the head of a pin? It's kind of a way to make fun of this type of theology. So the Pope did this, or in the West, in Catholicism, they did this. Well, then Luther came along, and he goes, you dummy. You're standing in the wrong spot. Don't stand there. Take a step over to the right, and from this perspective, this is what I see. And he wrote down every detail he could. And then Calvin said, you're right. The Pope was wrong, but you're also standing in the wrong spot. You actually have to stand over here, one step over. And he wrote down everything he could see. And then Zwingli came along and did that. And then one after another, and they're all standing in different places and trying to describe what they see. And the Orthodox look at this and go, there's no way I can put human words to this. This is a mystery. I'm just going to step right in the middle of it and experience it. And this is why when verbal and written theology is done in the Orthodox Church, it's usually forced. How is it forced? We'll talk about this with the ecumenical councils. A heresy pops up, and the church goes, wait a minute, what you're saying doesn't match with the way we've always been worshiping. We know this here, in the heart. In our hearts, we know that this is not true. There's something wrong about this. So now, darn it, you're going to force us to put this into words. I gave you that term before, hypostases. And that's for the person. You know, there's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The persons are hypostases. And the essence was ousia, know what the fathers of the church had to do with these terms? They had to redefine them in ways they were never defined before, because there was no language that fit what they were trying to say. So they kind of threw up their hands, oh, all right, fine. We have to put this in the language in order to put up boundaries so people know not to go over there where the heresy is, because that heresy is dangerous. If you live differently, if you believe differently, you're going to live differently. And if you live differently, you're going to get different results. In order to get the right results, you got to believe properly, and that's right here. And so now we got to put up these borders, and that's what the creed is. That's what it is. So Father John Romanidis, this great 20th century theologian, one of his teachings was, we have to transcend the creed. He says in heaven, we will never recite the creed, because we will have transcended created human language and will just experience the uncreated God in his energies directly. It's beautiful. It's awesome. This is why the saints say the language of heaven is silence. It doesn't mean we won't commune with one another. It just simply means human words will never be enough. Direct communion is what we want all the time. We get it, and it constantly grows and gets more and more beautiful. It's awesome. You see why I spent so much time on this uncreated, created distinction? We're starting to see how this actually has huge implications. Simply calling God creator means major things for us. Okay. So, theology is describing in human finite terms a God that is divine and infinite. I am not doing well on time. All right. In other words, theology is impossible. But there's still good and bad theology. There's still true and false theology. But perfect and precise theology is not possible. Not in language. Not in language. At the end of today's lecture, we're going to describe how true theology is done. But for now, just remember that line that theology is describing in human and finite terms a God that is divine and infinite. Thus, when we say that God, what God is not, we don't run into the problem of trying to use human and finite terms to define God. That's why apophatic theology is so important. It helps us avoid that problem. And there's a kind of a disconnect between the language and the reality. The language will help us lead towards the reality if we live the life. So the disconnect between the terms used and the one whom those terms describe falls away when we live it. But it also falls away a little bit when we use apophatic theology, saying what God is not. So now let's turn to cataphatic theology, because we don't just use apophatic theology. You have to say at some point what God is to some extent. This was a debate in the 20th century. Some theologians really discussed this a lot. And the great Romanian theologian, Dumitru Staneloi, is the one who I think comes up with the solution. Where he says, by saying what God is not, you are implying what God is, and therefore the two have to go hand in hand. But we rest firmly in the apophatic, and that leads us a little bit to the cataphatic. So what are some of the things we say about God that are true? We say what God is. We say he's omniscient. Omniscient. God is all-knowing. God knows all things, and because he's outside of time, he knows even things to come in our future, because there is no future with God. There's no past and future. It's just what it is. And so he knows these things. And some people believe that the foreknowledge of God, that he knows every action, word, and thought that we will ever have, and he knows everything that will happen, they think that this means that everything is foreordained, and therefore we have no free will. This is not what we mean. It's not what we mean. What it means is that God knows what we will choose. But he's not directing that choice for us. He simply knows what we will choose. He knows how things will turn out. You can think about this with Judas. I had somebody in high school when we were studying the Bible, and somebody said, you know, didn't Judas kind of do God a favor? Why? What are you talking about? Well, there were all these prophecies about somebody who would betray Christ, and therefore he was just simply fulfilling the prophecies. If Judas hadn't betrayed Christ, those prophecies would have never been fulfilled, and people would have thought Christ wasn't the Messiah. You're looking at it the wrong way. Who inspired those prophecies? The prophets didn't make them up on their own. God informed them. And God informed them because he knew what would happen. So the point of the prophecy wasn't to predict what might happen. The point of the prophecy was to say, this is going to happen, and I'm going to tell you about it ahead of time. Why tell everyone about it ahead of time? This is really important to understand if you want to understand prophecies in the Old Testament. A lot of people think prophecies were there simply to predict the future, and that's what a prophecy is. No, a prophecy exists so that you understand properly what the event means when it actually comes. As an example, the very time and place of Christ's birth are in the prophecies. Yet, were there crowds of people waiting there for his birth? No. Why? Because that wasn't the point. The point was that when he was born, people could look back in the Old Testament and go, oh my goodness, this matches up with what was said here and here exactly. And now, who this baby is, we really understand. You see? That's the point of the prophecy. So because Judas betrayed Christ, the prophecies about his betrayal were made. It's backwards, because God is outside of time. Okay. So God's foreknowledge in events of events doesn't make them happen. He foreknows them because he's outside of space and time. There's no future, past, or present with him. And he knows all things. It's as simple as that. So we have free will. He knows how we're going to use that. The more general problem with the concept of God being all-knowing is that we don't even know what there is to be known. So in other words, we don't just not know the answers to many of these theological questions and these ideas about why God allows things and doesn't allow things. We don't even know what the proper questions are often, because God works in a way that is so unfathomable to us. The way that God thinks is not the way we think. God's ways are not our ways. Okay, there's no brain with him. There's no firing of synapses. It's entirely unfathomable to us how God works. And this is why, pastorally, I want to tell you, it's very, very ridiculous. Honestly, it's a dumb thing to do, to accuse God of not understanding our situation. It's a pretty stupid thing. We do that. So, God just doesn't understand me. That's pretty ridiculous. It's a childish way of looking at God. Forgive me, it's foolish to do that. It doesn't mean we can't say, God, why? Please help me understand. But we don't accuse God when things don't go well in our life and then assume that he's somehow messing with us and he just doesn't understand what the ramifications of this would have been. It's a weird way of looking at it. God's knowledge is incomprehensible to us, and his desires are for our salvation fall into that category, which means God allows things in our lives that we simply won't understand. And many times I tell people, you can ask God why, but eventually if that answer doesn't come, you need to just rest in the knowledge that God loves us. And you may not understand why this happened until we come to the next life. But as you grow closer to Christ, you start to trust him more, and you start to trust that that's true. The reality is that even the mystery of our own salvation remains a mystery to us largely in our lives. We don't quite understand always why. I put in this text, do we understand this? No pun intended. Do we understand that we don't understand? It's a tough thing. It doesn't mean that we don't try to get to know God, but I want to tell you a quick story about this. It's pretty awesome. There's a beautiful story about a Russian traveler. And the Russian traveler was walking through various villages going to his destination. And along the way, he meets this man, this kind of mysterious man, who says, where are you going? He tells him, he goes, oh, I'm actually going to the same place. Do you want to walk together? Sure. It'd be nice to have some company. And of course, there's no Motel 6 along the way. And so what you do is you stop at people's houses and hope that they'll host you. And so they find this first house, and the people there are so loving. They immediately sit in this man and this traveler down at their table. They wash their feet. They get all their food together. They get out the very best thing that they have. They have this beautiful silver tray that they put in front of them with all this food. And then in the middle of the dinner, they say, oh, we have more food for you. We're going to go in the kitchen and get it. As soon as they leave, this mysterious traveler takes the tray and he throws it out the window. And it sinks into this pond they have out there. And the traveler looks at this guy and goes, what the heck did you just do? What did you just do? And you just keep quiet. So he decides to keep quiet about it. They stay the night, and in the middle of the night, they go, we better get out of here. So they shove off to the next place. They start walking all day. They come to a second house. Second house. This one's really bad. Beautiful family welcomes them. Got an older teenage son. They do the same thing. They welcome them with a great deal of joy. A lot of love. While the mother and the father go to fetch some food outside, this mysterious traveler goes up behind the son, wraps his hands around his neck, and kills him right there on the spot. The traveler looks at him and goes, we got to go now. You're psycho. And he grabs him by the scruff of the neck, and they go out. What is with you? I can't travel with you anymore. Let's just stop off at one more place. Stop off at the next place. This time they're not welcomed too kindly. The man who owns the home is a jerk with a capital J. This guy treats them horribly, gives them horrible food, is bitter that they showed up in the first place, but says, fine, I guess you can stay here. And this mysterious traveler takes out a bag of money. He says, here, I want you to have this. The first traveler is just like, what is going on? So they leave the next day. And he goes, that's it. I don't want to walk with you anymore. I don't get you. You're psycho. You're a nutcase. We're done. And just then, the mysterious traveler reveals himself to be an angel of light. And the guy goes, whoa, there's no way you're an angel. Look at all these horrible things you did. And the angel says, God's ways are not your ways. What's that supposed to mean to me? So what would I do that was so wrong? Well, that first family took us in. They were so kind to us. And the one good thing, they lived very humbly. The one good thing they had was that silver tray. And you threw it out into this bog and it's gone and they'll never have it again. He goes, yes. He goes, that's absolutely true. He goes, that family was a very pious family. But there's one thing they did in their life that was wrong. They stole that silver tray from somebody. And it ended up causing a lot of financial difficulties because it was the only nice thing they had. No one knew about this. And it was the one thing that they were going to be held to account for before the face of God because they had a great love for that tray that exceeded their love for God. It was the only nice thing they had. And so I got rid of it for them and I took away the temptation. And now they're going to repent. Okay. Because God's ways are not your ways. Fine. You killed somebody, their only son, at the second house. Explain that one away. Okay. He goes, it's a very, very kind family. Yes, yes. Pious family too. Yes, yes. And their son has been pious as well, up until this point. However, tomorrow, he was going to get together with some of his friends, and they were going to lead him into alcoholism, into drugs, into lust. He was going to fall away, and he was going to lose his soul. The only way that God could save him is if he took him while he was still ripe. And so he was plucked from this life while he was ripe. At the very last moment that salvation was possible for him. God's ways are not our ways. So the man says, all right, then explain the third one to me. This guy was a jerk. He was bitter. He wasn't pious at all. And yet you gave him money. It's true. He says, I gave him a small amount. He says, if you noticed, in his house, it was kind of run down. He didn't have the money to fix up his house. I gave him just enough money that they would rebuild some of the walls and they'd fix up the house. And the reason I did that is because this man is hated throughout his entire village. But little does he know that inside one of his walls are great treasures, much more money than I gave him. And the wall was going to continue to fall apart until he discovered that money, and he was going to use that money to obtain a lot of power and oppress all of his neighbors. So I protected them against that by giving them the small amount. He would fix up his house and therefore he would be unable to oppress those around him. God's ways are not our ways. Pretty awesome story, yes? This is what we have to remember with God. God's ways are not our ways. He sees things the way we don't. God sees with eyes that we don't. St. Anthony the Great had this happen one time where he wondered why it was that there were some very, very pious people who were poor and downtrodden and never seemed to catch a break, and yet there were also some very impious people, some people who were completely unrighteous, who seemed to have every ease in life and every good thing. And he pondered on this one day out in the desert, and he begged God for an answer, and finally God boomed out and said, Anthony, you can't see things the way I see things. I have a providence you'll never understand, so stop trying to delve into this and just focus on yourself and your own salvation. Let me take care of everybody else. That's the answer. That's the answer. We trust that God will take care of these things. Okay, let's look at the word omnipresent. God is everywhere. There's no way to get away from God. At the same time, we have to be careful about this because we wouldn't say, well, if God is everywhere, he's in this table right here, and therefore I'm going to worship that table. It doesn't quite work that way. So how do we understand God being everywhere? We could say this. Nothing exists without God continually upholding it. And we could call this general grace or creative grace. That grace is everywhere. Okay? And as such, God dwells everywhere. But using this table, I wouldn't say that this table reveals God and his majesty to us. Because there's a second function of God's will and his grace. And that's not just for something to be sustained, but rather for something to be sanctified. There's a sanctifying grace that we all seek. So think of it this way. All things after the fall are like a darkened panel. It's a panel with smudges and grease and all this junk all over it. with some things, and mainly with people, but also some objects, that panel can be cleaned and buffed and shined to the point that it becomes a mirror. And that mirror reflects the glory of God. This is what happens with icons or with a holy cross or things like that. But the panel can also be further tarnished, and it can oppose the glory of God. So take the example of like a tree, okay? In a tree, in paradise, trees didn't have any thorns. You couldn't scrape yourself on a tree. You wouldn't fall out of it and get hurt. There was some glory being reflected off of that. You could look at all of nature and see God's creative hand in this. The saints get to this point where they say, like, God reveals himself more and more through nature the more sanctified you are. But after the fall, trees kind of lose that sense of reflecting God's glory. But there's still a fingerprint there. There's still a fingerprint of God's glory. Okay? And what can you do with that tree? Well, I could take a branch of that tree and I could build a house with it. Okay? It's a nice thing. Is it necessarily a holy thing? Not necessarily. I could take that tree and I could carve out a stake. And I could kill somebody with that stake. I could mistake them for a vampire or something. My wife is from Transylvania, so that's a big part of my life. So, but well, now we've tarnished it more, right? That panel's been really tarnished. We've used it for something evil. We've abused it. We've obscured the glory of God found within it. Or we can carve that branch into a cross. Well, now suddenly we kiss it, and it's become holy. So you see, God is everywhere, but in corruption and death, we don't see that God is everywhere as a result of this fall. So God's presence isn't always prevalent to us. And if we deny and reject God, the presence of God is even less felt. This is why you can walk into like a church like ours, and hopefully you've experienced this, where you walk in and you go, man, this place has been prayed in. And you walk into a place where some evil has been done, and sometimes it feels heavy. You can sense it. It's just powerfully there. I think we're going to understand this more as we look to the final term. Omnipotent. God is all-powerful. So here we have to understand, we don't mean that everything that occurs happens because God wills it to be so. God allows things, but he doesn't will everything to happen, especially evil. Right? In other words, God being all-powerful means that he can do all things so long as doing such things does not contradict or negate his being, his power, or his goodness. There's that saying that some atheists like to bring up, can God create a boulder so heavy that he can't lift it? It's nonsensical. It's nonsensical because you're saying God can and can't at the same time. It doesn't make any sense to say that. Okay? But having the power and using the power are two different things. So when we hear all-powerful, I think normally we think of at the end of the Disney movie Aladdin, when Jafar asks to be the most powerful genie in the world, and he rises up with those, you know, rippling muscles. He has cosmic power, and this like gigantic lightning bolts everywhere, and he wants to use it for everything that he desires. And this is obviously not a proper image of God, but unfortunately, especially when we're young, we kind of have this image of being all-powerful. When we say that God is all-powerful or almighty, it doesn't take away from the fact that he respects human freedom. And also, we're going to talk about this probably next week, he's humble. So it's a shocking thing. We have a God who is humble, which is like such a paradox. There's no way we could wrap our mind around this. It's a shocking thing. You could not, no matter how hard you tried in all human history, before Christ was born, if you would have heard that someday God himself will become man, you would have assumed that he would be born in a great palace with all the riches of the world. Instead, he was born in a cave surrounded by stinking animals. And what image is that for us? We want God to be born in us as well, in holy communion, in our hearts. And what is our heart? It's full of stinking cow dung. It stinks. But we ask God to live that humility within us as well. It's awesome. It's awesome. So, anyway, the point of this is, when somebody goes crazy and goes on a shooting spree, sometimes you hear the question, why did God do this? No, it's the wrong question. God has the power to destroy the whole universe in less than a second, but he does not will this to happen, because that would interfere with his other cataphatic attribute, that he's righteous, merciful, and loving, and a respecter of human will. So he's not going to work against himself. So God can do all things that align with his very being, acts of holiness. He cannot do evil. He can allow evil, and sometimes that's a corrective for us. But he's not going to do evil himself, as we would define it, or anything that would separate us from him. And again, this is something we're going to cover more later. But hopefully, though, you see that each of the terms we've described are good in some ways, but bad in others. We have to be careful. We have to really define them along a long way. Omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. We really can't, in each of them, comprehend what we even mean by them. We have to really understand these words deeply and understand with long explanations. I just scratched the surface of all of these things. So this is why cataphatic theology is always a little bit dangerous for us. It can be really easily misunderstood, and even our human concept of what that term means doesn't quite match the reality of God, because uncreated. So I want to continue with some other cataphatic terms, but I don't want to go into too much detail with them, but I want to highlight the limitations and benefits of cataphatic theology a little bit more. So to the three terms we've discussed, we could add the words holy, righteous, merciful, just, and a whole host of other words, right? There's a lot of words we would use to describe God. But again, with each one of them, we have to admit the failure, both of human language and human understanding, to grasp what each means. So St. Gregory the Theologian talks about this. He says that we need to be careful not even to call God just. Why? He says God's justice is so beyond anything we could possibly understand or fathom, that to use the term is to bastardize or pervert the reality with a human conception that doesn't really match it. We have to be cautious with our language. Furthermore, he says, if God was really just in the way we understand it, then all of us would be in big trouble, because none of us would be saved. So God's justice is nothing like human justice. His mercy is nothing like human mercy, which is often why we struggle internally with our spiritual lives. We go, how could God possibly love me and be merciful to me? I'm so horrible. I'm so this, I'm so that. You have no clue whatsoever, which is why the fathers of the church give a lot of images. One of the images they like to give is they say, take a handful of sand, throw it into the ocean. Ocean, God's mercy. Sand, your sins. Rest easy. Calm down. But we have a tough time really understanding this. So whenever we say something positive about God, we then immediately have to negate it. God is merciful, but he's also not merciful, because our concept of merciful doesn't really match how merciful he is. God exists. One of my dogmatic professors at seminary said this one. He goes, you can't even really say God exists. Why? Because every concept for existence that you have is of a created thing, and therefore you have no concept of what it means to exist outside of space and time, to be uncreated. Does God exist? Yes and no. It depends on what you mean. Cataphatic theology has its limitations. So God is merciful. He is loving. He does exist, of course. But our human concepts don't really match up with what the reality is, and this is why we have to be so careful with our language about God, which is why we spend a lot more time praising God in the midst of the mystery rather than standing outside of it and trying to describe it. Okay. Again, I ask you, make sense? Any questions? Leo's like, Yeah, I told you it's going to get deep and tough, and I'm on page 9 of 13, and we have about 20 minutes. All right, let's see how we're going to do this. I got to read a little bit ahead and see where we are. Okay, I want to be certain that we have an understanding of God, a God that is so great, so beyond every human imagining, that right now, if I've done a good job right now, you're feeling a little uncomfortable because God seems so distant and so majestic and so powerful and so beyond us that it's almost impossible to even fathom a relationship with him, and you feel a little bit worried. If you feel worried right now, I've done my job. But that, I just want to start there. I don't want to deflate you completely, because that's not our God. But at least it's not the whole story. But we need to start with that understanding for three reasons, okay? Number one, I want to start there so that we can see why we talk about God in the way we do, why we're so careful with our language, and why we spend so much time praising him rather than just describing him all the time. Number two, so that we can understand why the Orthodox Church worships the way it does with such extravagance. We're going to talk about this more hopefully in the future, but there's a reason that the services should describe the majesty of God. You should kind of stand in awe with these things. We had some visitors last week who said they came to their first service and they said, how refreshing that you guys hold God so highly, and it shows in your worship. And number three, so that we can understand, for 2 weeks from now when we talk about Christ, just how incredible what I mentioned before is, how humble Christ really is. How humble God is for us, and how much he really does love us. So for today, I just want to focus, as we start to wrap up, about the first point, why do we talk about God the way that we do? If God, as we've been discussing, is beyond every human conception, then how are we, by necessity, to end up talking about him? Necessarily, we talk about him in imperfect ways. That's how. When we talk about God, our language is always imperfect. By necessity, if we talk about God, it must be done with imperfect language. So how do we talk about God? Well, we have to use terms and analogies and characteristics that we understand from our interaction with creation and then go to apply them to God, but knowing all the way through that this is an imperfect method. This is one of the reasons that St. Augustine, who we love in the church, but we love him as a father of piety more than a father of theology. And Catholicism, they love St. Augustine, they base everything off of him. We're very, very cautious of him because he went too far with some of this. With his Trinitarian theology, he applied too many human concepts to God. And he tried to dogmatize those, and he wasn't as careful. We still love him. He's an incredible saint, especially his life story. I mean, if you've never read the Confessions, you should. But we're cautious with him. So, we have to understand, we use part of creation that we intimately know, which is closest to God, and this is our fellow man. Man was made, as the scriptures say, in the image and likeness of God. So man was modeled after divine attributes. And thus the best and holiest parts of man give us a glimpse into God. When somebody becomes really close to God, so they can say with St. Paul, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. We begin to understand God much better. Which is why meeting holy people is such an important thing. Which is why I'm such a shame of a priest. I'm not a holy priest. But by all means, go to a monastery with a holy monastic. Life-changing? Yes. Pam, life-changing? Yeah. First time I met a nun like this, she looked at me and started telling me things that we never talked, and she knew details about my life. All she did was look at me, and I looked in her eyes, and she looked through me. And it just rushed into me, and I had 24 hours where I was like not walking on this earth. I was somewhere else. That was such a transformative experience, and that's when I went, oh my goodness, that's what all this theology is talking about. That's when St. Paul says it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. He wasn't just using poetic language. He was saying something real. And I just met somebody who's like that. I've met a few people like that in my life. Who you just stunned when you walk away. This is what we're all trying to move towards. So I mentioned being made in the image and likeness of God. Some of the attributes. Or maybe I didn't mention it, but God's freedom and God's love, these are two things that we really look for. And I want to just make a quick aside about this. It's really important that of all the things I could have picked to talk about man's attributes that kind of show us who God is, I could have picked more than two, but the two I picked were freedom and love. And so why? Why didn't I pick bitterness or resentment or vindictiveness? Why not pick laziness or greed or arrogance or haughtiness? Well, within man, we could say, because the image of God, however stained it is, because this image is still within us, we have deep longings and desires for the fullness and completion of that image. There is, in other words, ingrained in man a longing for eternity, for whole and unconditional and perfect love, for purity and true freedom from what? From a slavery to sin. A longing to escape from brokenness and alienation and enter into wholeness. Why does this exist in man? Well, the only reason that makes perfect sense is that the imprints of these things still remain in the heart of man. And these help us to tell us what God is like. God wouldn't give us these desires for perfect wholeness and freedom from sin and love if those weren't available somewhere and they're available in him. This is one of St. Augustine's famous lines. My heart is restless until it finds rest in thee, O Lord. This is the heart that we have. So God's fingerprint still remains in our souls. And the very fact of the existence of God and some of his attributes can be found in man because only in man is the longing for God instinctively ingrained. He doesn't have to find a way to acquire this longing. It's already there. We're born with it. We just long for these things right off the bat. This is why kids cry when they get in trouble. They begin to wonder, do mom and dad still love me? This is why parents have to be very careful with their kids and constantly tell their kids, I love you and that's why you're being punished. Man just needs to discover the fulfillment of this longing properly. And this is what the entire church is about, is showing us that God is the fulfillment. What we do is we look for the fulfillment other places. I need to feel fulfilled. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to find it in food. I'm going to find it in gambling. I'm going to find it in entertainment. I'm going to find it in this and this and this. And we always end up disappointed and depressed eventually. Only in God is it properly fulfilled. So with this aside in mind, let's get back to attempting to describe God by looking at the best of human attributes. And I want to repeat, in using human conceptions to speak of God, we knowingly must use imperfect terms while understanding that their meanings will be imprecise at best. And still, we need some sort of terminology. And for this reason, God, the scriptures speak of God in human terms. And if we think about them, sometimes they don't make sense. For instance, scriptures talk about God being a jealous God, from Deuteronomy 4:24, or of God repenting, right? God repents when he's going to go into Nineveh. They talk about him as being gracious and compassionate, but also angry towards those who forsake him. They talk about God's ears and arms and hands, about him walking in paradise, and they give all sorts of human terminology to God's attributes and even emotions. And yet they also speak, the scriptures also speak about God being unchanging. How does it make sense? If God is unchanging, how could he repent? How can a God who is unchanging and uncreated have human limbs, or be gracious and loving one minute and angry another, and repent the next? If we understand everything that's been said so far, we understand the scriptures are just doing what we have to do. They're using human and finite terms to describe the indescribable. And they're using it in ways that we can understand it. So the fathers of the church talk then, and they describe the effects of God's work in us as changing based on where we are in our life, how holy we are, unrighteous, or what our understanding is. And so I want to describe what I mean by that. The saints of the church talk about God as fire. And they say fire has two properties, right? It can either enlighten or it can burn. So what are we? What have we created ourselves to be so that we experience God properly? It's the same fire in both cases. When the fire of God's divinity, due to our sinfulness, burns us, we talk about God's anger and wrath. But it's not God who became angry. God didn't change. We changed. Or when we live a holy life and we sense God's grace, we talk about his love and mercy. It's not that he was angry with us one minute and then loves us the next. He loves us all the way through, but we couldn't experience that love as it was intended. So we use these human terms to talk about what the attributes of God look like based on where we are. Okay? So think of there's a simple example of this that confuses a lot of people. Moses rises up in Egypt. He says, "Let my people go," right? "Let my people go." And Pharaoh, we're told, rejects this because why? God hardened his heart. And people go, wait a minute. God made Pharaoh disagree with Moses and fight against him? Is that what's happened here? There's a really beautiful image the fathers give where they say our hearts, this is our choice, our hearts can be one of two elements. Like one of two elements. Our hearts can be like clay or like wax. Place clay and wax out into the midday sun. And what happens? The clay hardens while the sun beats upon it. The wax softens. The same sun, which doesn't change, has very different effects on two very different elements. So I was listening to some Catholic radio a little while ago, and they talked about how when this happened to Pharaoh's heart, God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart by doing something physical. He just removed himself from Pharaoh and left him. No, that's also incorrect. God shines upon the good and the evil alike. But what happened is that Pharaoh himself decided to have a heart of clay. And so the more God shone upon him, whatever the word is, the more he did it, the more hardened his heart became. And that's how God hardened his heart, while softening many of the Israelites' hearts. You see? So this is why we use that human language. God became angry. God became jealous. God became this. God became that. It's really how God's grace affects us based on how we are. Do we understand that? Any questions there? Okay, how are we doing? Terribly. Let's keep going. So if you're paying really close attention, you've already discovered something strange. This unapproachable, unfathomable God, whose very essence and being exists outside of comprehension, is talked about in scriptures as a God who relates to us. In other words, when we ask the question, who is God, we answer that he is beyond all human understanding, that he is almighty beyond all wonder, and yet he is also personal and desires to be near us. And this is not what we would call a contradiction. A contradiction can't exist within God. It's a paradox. So how can this be? How can such a great and mighty God wish to be close to his creation? The question isn't so much how, but why. And we know how. God is all-powerful. If he desires to be close to us, then he can make it happen. God can do whatever he wants. But why? And the answer comes from one cataphatic description of God, which, again, human conception can't fathom the depth of this, the meaning of this phrase, but which we find in 1 John 4:8. God is love. God is love. This is one of the few cataphatic theological statements you'll find in Scripture. God is love. Why did God create in the first place? Why are we here? Because God is love, and He seeks to share that love and to bring the wholeness and fulfillment of that love to each and every one of us. He created us because He is love, and that love needs to be shared. Not in the sense that God was required to create us, but He had a desire to share that love with us. God is love. This is our God. This is who He is and what He is. He is personal. He is one. And above all else, He is love. This is a love which, if experienced, causes man to be struck dumb in awe. He ceases to speak. St. Paul talks about experiencing a glimpse of heaven, which is the kingdom of God's love. And he says, first, that he wasn't sure if he was in the body or out of it. And second, that the experience was so beyond human conception that it would be unlawful for him to try and to put into words. The experience is so great, human words will never suffice. I could write 10 volumes on how great this was. It wouldn't even come close to the real experience, and therefore it would be unlawful for me to describe it. This is God Almighty. This is God as love. But the Scriptures say that God does not dwell in filth. He doesn't dwell in sin and unrighteousness. So, in order to achieve that experience that St. Paul had, in order to understand that we have a God who desires, we started with this, a God who desires to be known, who wants to reveal Himself to us. This is how the saints know about God's attributes, by the way, is God reveals Himself to them. We need to make a clean dwelling place for Him to reside. And Christian theology from the very beginning has taught that the place where God desires to reside is the human heart. So this is what Christianity is. Far from being a simple religious option among many others, far from being just new ideas and a new philosophy, Christianity is first and foremost a way, a method, a therapeutic method for the purification of human hearts. This is what it's all about. This is why I started with what true catechism is. True catechism is living the life. Why? You want to purify your heart. Because head knowledge, which I'm giving you, I gave you a lot of head knowledge right now, it's all well and good. It's going to mean peanuts when you stand before the throne of God. Heart knowledge is what we seek. We seek a pure heart so that God can reveal Himself to us. Now, you may sit there and say, some of these great and exalted saints, I'll never reach their state here in this life. Yeah, probably most of us won't. That's the truth. But does it mean that the average Christian can't start to taste this stuff and start to enter this ministry, this mystery? No. I know simple parishioners who you would just think as normal people who would just have you over at their house, you have them over at yours, they're just friends, no big deal. I know parishioners who have seen angels and archangels, who have seen saints walking around, who have heard the voice of saints speaking to them, who have seen the uncreated light. I know a teenager who was literally blinded because he saw the uncreated light. This was at a camp I was working at. He was struck blind. He was on the ground writhing back and forth with his palms over his eyes. He had to be carried back to his bunk. And a priest had to come, and the priest immediately placed his cross on him to make sure it wasn't demonic. And after about an hour, he gained his sight back, and he described to this priest what happened. The priest told me in confidence, he said, the way he described what he saw is exactly how the saints described the uncreated light of God. Like Moses coming down from the mountain and his face shining so brightly people couldn't look at him. This is a kid. I know others who have heard the voice of the seen the Theotokos, seen Christ. Parishioners. This is not out of the realm of possibility for us. But our goal isn't to see and experience great things. There's a monk on Mount Athos. Somebody asked him. He was very elderly. He'd been on Mount Athos for like 60 years. And somebody said, oh, after 60 years, you must have had some great experiences. He said, no, I've had none. And I'm happy about it. I thank God for that. I said, why? And he goes, I don't want any consolation in this life. I want it all to be saved for the next. If I get it now, it won't be saved for me in the next. I'd rather have it now. So I've prayed to God never to let me have visions. That's awesome. We have other saints like St. Porphyrios, who we commemorated last week, or St. Nicholas, who saw many great things. I was reading about St. Nicholas this morning. He refused to nurse all day Wednesdays and Fridays when he was an infant until the evening because he wanted to fast. God gave him this abundant grace because he knew what he was going to do with it. And boy, did he multiply that grace. Boy, did he multiply it. So having spent a lot of time on how God's greatness and glory is so vast and so infinite and so perfect that it's beyond comprehension, we always come back to the same fact that God created us so that he could be close to us. So that his greatness and glory, as infinite and perfect and indescribable as they are, can actually come into contact with us and unite with us. This is the God that we worship. This is a shocking thing. This is why Christianity, properly understood, is a scandal. St. Paul talks about in Romans how we are heirs and co-heirs with Christ. What does it mean to be an heir? An heir is one who everything the Father has will be given to him. And the fathers talk about this. They say that all that God is by nature, we will become by grace. I had a man who he was bedridden. He had, I forget the name of the illness that dealt with his back, but he couldn't walk. He'd been bedridden for years. He was always suffering, constant suffering, all day, every day. And I described this to him one time, and he goes, all that God is by nature, we will become by grace. We are co-heirs with Christ. Co-heirs? Everything given to Christ will be given to us? He said, this sounds like blasphemy. And I said, oh, thank God, you get it. You get it. You get Christianity. It's a shocking faith because this majestic God desires this for us. This is what he wants for us. We can touch and even unite with God. And the next weeks we'll explore why and how. So you may have wondered why we haven't talked much about the Holy Trinity. Again, we're going to save that when we talk about the ecumenical councils. I think this is all foundational. We needed to kind of delve into the stuff first. I know it was tough, but we got through quite a bit of it. I want to end with just a few comments on why it even matters that we believe these proper things about God. Why is it important that we believe? If God is so majestic, human words will never suffice. Why is it important that we even believe these things in the first place? Why does it matter to even mentally try to understand God at all? And by the way, you can live that holy life without fully understanding these things to begin with. One of my professors in seminary, Father George Dragas, he's a great, great professor, great priest. Great priest. He was taught by two of the greatest theologians of the 20th century, Father John Romanidis, who I mentioned earlier, and Father George Florovsky. I mean, untouchable. And these are great theologians. He was taught by them. And so he asked us one day, he goes, who do you think was the greatest theologian who ever taught me? And some people immediately said, Father George Florovsky, clearly. He goes, no. He goes, oh, wow, you think Romanidis was greater? He goes, no, it wasn't Romanidis either. He says, it was my yaya, which in Greek is grandmother. It was my yaya. He said, why? He said, because whenever my yaya would have a problem, very pious woman, prayed every day, went to church as much as possible. Whenever my yaya would have a problem, she'd go to the icon in her house of St. John the Forerunner and verbally ask him what to do about the situation, and she'd come back with an answer. And he said, when I was young, I had a problem. My yaya said, well, go ask St. John. And so I went, and I said, St. John, this is my problem. What should I do? And he goes, nothing happened. So I looked at yaya, and I said, yaya, I didn't hear anything. And she said, you didn't hear him? He just said to do this, 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 and this. She would actually have conversations, full-on conversations with St. John. He goes, she couldn't have defined hypostases for me. She couldn't have said what ousia was. She couldn't define any of this theology, but she had the theology of the heart. But is it still important to try to get some of the head knowledge? Yes. Why? Because we want to keep ourselves safe from the wrong knowledge. The wrong knowledge is the stuff that is really dangerous. Okay. The reality is that today this idea is floating around quite a bit that what you believe doesn't matter. As long as you try to be a good person, what you believe doesn't matter. It's hooey. It's baloney. People say different beliefs will lead you to the same God. But this would mean that our beliefs have no effect on us. It's not true. That would mean then your beliefs are useless. You know? And saying that your beliefs don't have an effect on anything, guess what? That itself is a belief, which you think has an effect on you. So there's circular knowledge here circular reasoning that doesn't really work. People say it doesn't matter what you believe as long as you're a good person, but then they demand that you accuse you of being a bad person when you live the way they want. How do you know what a good person is without beliefs? Different beliefs cause us to answer that question, what is good, in different ways. In other words, this goes back to what we talked about, lex orandi, lex credendi. The rule of prayer is the rule of faith. Beliefs and practices are connected. And this is another line that I would ask you to try to memorize. Our beliefs inform our worship, and our worship informs our belief. Our beliefs inform our worship, and our worship informs our beliefs. It's like a teeter-totter or a scale. When you change something on one side, the other side has to change to balance out. It has to happen. Which is why the Orthodox Church is so... That's just a modernized version of Lex Orandi, Lex Credendi. Our beliefs inform our worship, and our worship inform our beliefs. This is why Orthodoxy is so careful about changing things. We're very cautious about changing services. We're very cautious about changing anything. Because we know that if you change the way you worship, how you believe will come along with it. If you change what you believe, how you worship is going to change as well. This is why Orthodoxy guards its beliefs and practices so carefully. And it's why I can't just walk in each week and decide what hymns I'm going to do and how I'm going to do the service that week. And, you know, this week, I'm tired of going around the church that way. I'm going to go out the other door and go the opposite way. Or, you know, I'm going to include some liturgical dancing in it. It's some of my favorite videos on YouTube. You can look up liturgical dancing. So my favorite one has this altar boy, and he walks out with his candles. He's holding, this is not Orthodox, by the way, but he walks out, and he's cranking it around as he's dancing, and it's like the most hilarious thing in the world. And I'm just like, I don't know that I could worship while watching an altar boy do that. I would just like, I'd bust out, I'd have to leave the church. Even as the priest, I would just put like, you take the gospel, I gotta go. You know, it just happens. We're very cautious. We stand in awe of God all the time, and we make sure that we live the faith, not that was just passed down to us. Otherwise, this is just an ancient old relic, and we're just doing it because it's old. No. The faith still has power, which is why saints are still being made today. We don't mess with that power because we see the results. It's not because it's old, it's because it's revealed. I go back to that point. God reveals himself to us, and he reveals how we ought to live and how we ought to worship. And you don't mess with God. You don't sit there and say, I think I can improve upon what God gave us. That's the height of pride. Orthodoxy will not do that. It refuses to do it. And I've seen priests try to do it, and it always destroys the parish. It destroys the parish. So, why are beliefs important? I'm going to end with this. Well, a couple reasons. Number one, as I said, it changes how you interact with God. It changes how you worship, how you live the Christian life, if you believe the wrong things about God. So as an example, what if I was given a lot of homilies on the importance of marriage? What if I was given a lot of homilies on the importance of keeping your marriage sacred? And what if you believed, falsely, that I was having an affair? Would you listen to my words very much? Probably not. Would your relationship with me change? Probably quite a bit. That false belief would really affect your relationship with me. If we believe properly, we can have a proper relationship. This is one of the reasons, in confession, I tell people this all the time. When they believe someone has done something wrong, but they don't know for sure, I always say, you need to go talk to that person and have a real conversation before you go making accusations. Because once you go down that road, and by the way, that'll happen with you, not just towards family members, towards one another, but towards me and Father Justin. It happens all the time. And people go, you know, I heard that you were doing that. Wait a minute. Do you want to hear the full story before you make a judgment about this? Well, I've been mad at you for weeks and I don't want to talk to you. Yeah, but you haven't talked to me yet. You don't know if this is true. That happens. That happens. This is, you know, the devil plays around in parishes. What we believe changes how we interact with somebody, including God. And there's a second image that I want you to understand. There's actually a couple different versions of this, but one says that there's a straight and narrow path that Christ talks about towards salvation. And what are the doctrines? They're the signposts on the side of the road to keep you on the straight and narrow. But I had a priest change this for me, and I liked this a lot. He said, while that is true, the doctrines are signposts that keep us on the proper way, because beliefs and practices go together. If this is really therapy for the soul, therapy for your heart, then different beliefs create different medicines. And if you take the wrong medicine, it makes you sicker rather than better. You want to take the right medicines. It's true. But he gave this image. He says, I like the image better of the mystery of God is an ocean. And the proper doctrines float in that ocean as platforms off of which you dive into the mystery of God. If you're on the wrong platform, you're probably on the wrong ocean. Even if you have one that looks the same. So this is what false doctrine does. It drops a little poison into the water. And we dive into what we think is the mystery of God, and we start to get sick. And the further off we are from that, the sicker we get. We're not being cured, we're actually not being healed, we're actually being made sicker. And so this is why we start with this, who is God? We start with these difficult concepts because I want you to understand, at least to some extent, who it is that we're trying to have this relationship with. And if we have improper notions of this, it can really affect our spiritual lives, which again, you know, we talked about this. I'm such a miserable sinner, there's no way God could love me. A lot of people come in with that. A lot of people come in with that. Or, I sinned, and therefore I know God is just angry with me. He's just furious with me. Happens a lot. It happens a lot. Based on what I just described today, you know, that's not really the case. You may be experiencing God as anger, but that's not really what happened. So one of the things we'll talk about when we talk about spirituality, we tend to think of sin. This is a very Western concept, that when I sin, I'll give you an icon here to look at on my phone. First, I'm going to get rid of all my notices. Okay, so here's Christ. Okay, we tend to think of it this way. I sin, and now Christ is mad at me, and he's turning away from me. And so what do I do in my prayer? Oh, please, I'm so sorry, please. Come on, just look back at me. Come on, please, I'm so sorry. And eventually, I feel better again because God has looked back at me. The very definition of sin is to miss the mark. In other words, it's that I'm not focused on God. I'm the one who turned. This is proper understanding. When I sin, it's not Christ who turns from me. He always looks upon me, but I've turned from him. And so why don't I notice his gaze on me? Because I'm the one who changed. Sin doesn't affect God. Sin affects me. It's one of the big mistakes. We'll talk about this when we talk about the fall. In the West, they said, when Adam and Eve sinned, God became angry. And then he punished them with death. No. When Adam and Eve sinned, sin didn't affect God and make him angry. Sin affected man because man turned away from his source of life. God longs to be with us. He longs to dwell within us. He longs for that relationship. We have to make room for him by purifying this. And in order to do that, we need to make sure we think properly about him. So, okay. I went a little bit longer than I wanted, but not horribly so, not disastrously so. So please forgive me. Questions? Any questions? We ran through a lot. That was a lot. Yes? That was a lot to go through. And again, we're trying to pack it through. Most of the other lectures won't be this heavy, I promise. They're going to be a little bit lighter. Hopefully you'll enjoy them. Hopefully you enjoyed this one. But are there any questions? Okay.
Question online. Can you type it in? Because I don't know how to use this. Oh, here you go.
Go for it. So I had a question about the Father and the Son, because I used to... I don't know if it's true, but I believe that, you know, because of reading the Bible in Arabic, that the Son of God means that he is of God only. But is he literally the Son of God in a way we cannot describe?
We're going to talk about that when we get to the Trinitarian theology and the ecumenical councils.
Oh.
And that the first ecumenical council, that's an explanation. I don't want to jip and give you a two-sentence explanation when it's much more complex. But he is eternally the Son. There was never a time when the Son was not. He is always begotten of the Father. And what that means, we'll talk more about when we get to the ecumenical councils.
Another question is that when you were speaking about having everything later through God's mercy, I read about like the tears in heaven, and that was kind of confusing, that some people
tears,
can be lower
not
higher
tears.
Than others.
Okay, so we're going to talk about that with the last lecture when we talk about life after death, but just as a preview of that, she's asking about, like, she's read about this idea of people having different levels of experiences in heaven. And that's true in the sense that the grace that we have obtained will decide how much we experience the glory of God in heaven. However, two a little addendums to that. Number one, you won't be able to look at someone and see that they are of some higher level or having a greater experience than you, because otherwise heaven would have sorrow. There's no sorrow in heaven, so you won't be able to see it. And secondly, in heaven, even though we are now in transfigured time, there's a sense that we're always progressing. Why? God is infinitely perfect. And so St. Gregory of Nyssa says, we're constantly perfecting our perfection, or we're moving from glory to glory in heaven. And so our ascent never ends. And that's part of the reason that we pray for the departed. You may say, well, they lived a very pious life. I'm sure they're saved. Okay, they may be, but can our prayer not help them? You're constantly ascending. Let's ascend faster. You know, that's all there is to it. So we'll talk about that more in the seventh lecture. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you all so much. We're going to head up to Vespers now. Again, forgive me for going a little bit long and for this being a little bit heavy. If any questions arise during the week, feel free to email me. Otherwise, we'll meet next Saturday, 4 o'clock. And we'll head into the next topic, which is now that we understand God more, we'll understand who man is and what the fall really was about. Okay? Thank you so much.